far building, Darrell and I did not get on well at all together. He complained about my leaning on stores, about my losing briefcases and trams and misplacing his books. And I found his finickety attention to detail absolutely impossible to tolerate. We didn't last long. But over the years, I grew to appreciate his attention to detail and a rather incredible sensation function that really enjoys indexing books and made me come down to actually finding the accurate footnote for a quote that I would just assume throw off the top of my head it belongs to somebody somewhere. Darrell has spoken on conflict, projection, dreams in previous years with the society, and tonight he's going to speak on the purpose of neurosis. Darrell Sharp.
Excuse me, would you mind if I plug my little machine in here, because I don't have any. My battery's out, you can run into the thing, so.
Sounds like this is on. Well, I'm going to bring some books up here just so I feel safe. I may not look at them, but that's what Fraser was talking about. I should add thanks for Fraser and a little note to that I also have grown to appreciate the way he functions, which symptomatically often turns up as leaving on stoves and losing my books and so on. But it has its advantages, just as the way I function has its advantages, and so in many ways we're shadow figures to each other. This, in fact, is very apropos to what I'm going to talk about, because as we'll see in what we call neurosis, it's often a matter of integrating consciously what we generally react to in the outside world as part of ourselves, which we aren't aware of, and that's what's called the shadow side of the personality, and it has positive potential as well as things that we'd rather not look at. Now, as Fraser said, the topic for discussion tonight is the purpose of neurosis. And I want to say right at the beginning that I'm not going to try to convince you that there is a purpose to neurosis. I think the only thing that can do that is to have a so-called nervous breakdown and see after some time that there was some positive issue to it. What I'm going to do is talk about Jung's view of neurosis, and it's close to my own experience, and talk about the ways in which energy moves within the person towards a more healthy, balanced perspective on life. And I'm going to start by quoting a definition of neurosis that I found in the dictionary I have, which is an American dictionary, the American Heritage Dictionary. And there it defines neurosis as any of various functional disorders of the mind or emotions without obvious organic lesion or change and involving anxiety, phobia, or other abnormal behavior symptoms, also called psychoneurosis. Now, that doesn't sound very promising, and it certainly carries no implications of a possible purpose. we can really see in this definition the general view of neurosis as something unhealthy. And this view, it seems to me, is based on the medical model of physical illness, according to which symptoms, when they do appear, are something to be cured. Now, in these terms, such states as anxiety and depression have no more purpose than a brain tumor or a case of the flu. One operates to remove the tumor, you take penicillin for the flu, and you try to get rid of depression by taking a tranquilizer. On the other hand, there is the view of Jung, which I share, in which, first of all, becoming more conscious is an evolutionary imperative. I think we'll come back to that, but if you can remember that term, an evolutionary imperative, which is Jung's, we'll perhaps come back to that. And secondly, neurosis and neurotic conflicts develop precisely in order to force an individual onto a new level of awareness. Now, to give an overview of Jung's attitude to neurosis, I want to tell you first of all of what he said to a group of London doctors in 1935. These remarks are published as part of the Tavistock lectures. In the question period, a certain Dr. Dix says to Jung, "I think we can assume then, Professor Jung, that you regard the outbreak of a neurosis as an attempt at self-cure, as an attempt at compensation by bringing out the inferior function." And Jung answered, "Absolutely." And Dr. Dix went on, "I understand then that the outbreak of a neurotic illness, from the point of view of a person's development, is something favorable." And Jung answered, "That is so, and I am glad you bring up that idea. That is really my point of view. In many cases, we have to say, thank heavens he could make up his mind to be neurotic. Neurosis is really an attempt at self-cure," still quoting Jung, "just as any physical disease is part an attempt at self-cure. It is an attempt of the self-regulating psychic system to restore an uneven balance, in no way different from the function of dreams, only rather more forceful and drastic." Now, this really is a viewpoint that's basic in analytical psychology, certainly part of my view and most Jungian analysts that I know. Because a consequence of it is that neurotic conflicts and such things as anxiety and depression are purposive, and not merely the result of what happened in childhood. It also means that there's some point to the suffering that is invariably part and parcel of what we call neurosis. Now, this attitude, the one that Jung has, can mean more than simply consolation for the neurotic. It can really literally mean the difference between life and death. Now, how, or let's say, what in Jung's view is neurosis? Let's try to get a little closer to what he sees as neurosis, as opposed to the definition that we read, which described it as an abnormal disorder. Well, one thing that Jung said is this: the moment of the outbreak of neurosis is not just a matter of chance. As a rule, it is most critical. It is usually the moment when a new psychological adjustment, that is, a new adaptation, to either the inner or the outer world is demanded. By the outbreak of neurosis, Jung here means a functional breakdown in the personality. Now that can manifest in the form of a depression or extreme anxiety, which prevents one from doing one's normal job, outbursts of rage, fear at going into the outside world. There are many possible ways it can manifest. I think in general it's what we would call in popular terms a nervous breakdown. Another quote of Jung's, the psychological trouble in neurosis and the neurosis itself can be formulated as an act of adaptation that has failed. And this can be rephrased as a psychologically inadequate response to the demands of reality. And early, very early on, when he was still working with Freud, and just about to break with him around 1911, Jung said and wrote, I no longer see the cause of a neurosis in the past, that is in childhood traumas, but in the present. I ask, what is the necessary task which the patient will not accomplish? Now, broadly speaking, as is apparent in when you read much of Jung's work, and as I have experienced in myself and see in the people that I work with, the task that is so difficult to accomplish for the individual is simply to grow up. I say simply, but in practice, that is one of the most difficult things that we are faced with in life. So that when Jung speaks as he does in some of his writings as individuation being a task of the second half of life, and that most of his patients don't reach a realization of the meaning of life until the second half of life, one must keep in mind that for the most part, very few people reach the second half of life psychologically. For most of us, it is well beyond the second half of life where we have actually grown out of our initial adolescent attitudes to life, which prevent our adaptation to new situations. So in Jung's view, broadly speaking, the psychological development of an individual is dependent on and concurrent with a continual adaptation to both the external and the internal worlds. In terms of the internal world, this can manifest as an inability for an individual to accept certain things that he comes across in the outside world. And what this seems to indicate is an inner sense of integrity and decency to the individual personality, which has its own parameters in terms of what the individual can be involved in, whether it's a life that one from outside might call promiscuous, or even a particular job. What this happens to be in every case is individual and depends very much on the context. I want to give you a view of a brief sketch of Jung's model of the psyche and his view of psychic energy, which differs from Freud's view of libido, because I think without that we can't really appreciate what Jung suggests happens in a neurotic breakdown. So first I'm going to put on the blackboard a brief description a schema of what actually happens in Jung's terms when a person has a breakdown.
Difficulty in adaptation is the first factor, let's say. And that can be a difficulty in adapting to what one is in oneself or a situation that one meets in the outside world. Now this goes along with a difficulty progression of energy. What that looks like is depression. Energy is no longer going out in a positive thrust to creating an outside world that will respond or be part of one's life. Leads in turn to a regression of libido. Now remember that in Jung's terms, libido does not mean simply sexual energy as it does in Freud's model. Libido means any kind of instinctual energy that is in the service of life. Have a look at that book. Regression of libido. As the energy is no longer is going into the outside world, but is going back into the individual, it activates certain contents in the psyche. Energies. Be associated with what's called in Jungian psychology the inferior function. I'll come back to that in a minute. Complexes. Complexes are characterized by a lot of emotion being tied up with them. Their psychic contents that have a very strong feeling tone, and they can be of the type that Fraser was referring to and I was too, where someone else seems to carry the qualities that you can't stand, primarily because they are qualities of, that are you also have that are unconscious in yourself. Now this is generally felt to be the case in psychology, not only Jungian psychology, because we're all human and we all have the potential for evidencing various characteristics. When we speak of the shadow, we're speaking of the other side of what we normally are conscious of in ourselves. Sometimes these are negative qualities and criminal inclinations, but just as often they're creative potentials that can manifest in a different way of functioning. And understand the inferior function, you really have to know a little bit about Jung's model of typology, which I'll briefly sketch in. It's a fourfold quaternity. It doesn't matter which one is here, but I'm going to put mine at the top because that's the one I'm most. Now, inferior doesn't carry the connotation in Jung's description of something that isn't as good as something else. It means more primitive and less developed. A simple, rather easy way of remembering what these functions, sensation, intuition, thinking, and feeling, how they operate, is this way. In any given situation, sensation will tell you that something exists, and thinking will tell you what it is, feeling will tell you what it's worth to you, and intuition will tell you what you can do with it, what are its possibilities. Remember that emotion is not part of this model. Emotion will contaminate any one of these functions. Feeling doesn't stand for an emotional response to people. That's more in this area. Complex, when it's constellated, when it's activated, has a lot of emotion with it. So when a person is very emotional, whether it's positive or negative, you know there's a complex that is dominating the personality. Okay, among the complexes, let's say there's the shadow that I've referred to, and that may be if a person is predominantly a thinking type, then he may need situations which demand a different kind of adaptation. He may need a situation where thinking is no longer of any use and feeling is required. In practice, this is the most difficult the situation at all, where the opposite function is demanded to meet a new situation. And so in practice, one has to go through a psi, one of the auxiliary functions, to get to that. This, any particular individual, the inferior function is usually always less developed and more primitive than others. But a word of caution here, this is a very dynamic model and not static, so it's not something that you can label yourself or others with. There are different situations in which a sensation type will function as intuitive. But in those situations, what he has to learn is to realize that that's how he's functioning and that that's where he's, where that isn't working so well. This may be the one to deal with that particular situation coming into. Now, by dynamic, I mean it's always changing. Over a period of many years, one can often see in oneself or others that they have a predominantly superior function. That is, the way they mostly work best is in a particular area, in a particular way. Now, among the complexes also are what's called the contrasexual components. That's the anima and animus. The anima in a man is feminine side, which is often evident that what one calls a man's anima development is apparent by the way he responds to women and what his attitude is to what are traditionally called feminine values, that is, passivity. I'm not saying this belongs to women, but it's a traditional feminine principle. Passivity and receptivity, the capacity to simply be. The animus, traditionally as a principle associated with the masculine, is involved with the capacity of doing. And over the years, culturally, the capacity for doing has been tagged on to men, and the opposite for being has been tagged on to women. Everything now, in the last 20, 50 years, and it makes much more sense not to tag things on to men and women, but to speak simply in terms of principles of masculine and feminine, because both men and women have these principles operating within them. Part of the way of functioning is also introversion and extroversion. Now, there are some people, this is the way they do describe it, there are some people who respond on the whole towards the outer world and go towards it and are affected by it. And they have very little to do with their own inner life. And these people he designated as extroverts. Call it extroversion. Extroversion is a thrust into the world. Introversion the introverted personality takes things into himself and relates things primarily in terms of his own experience of himself. The extroverted personality tends to be more inclined to outer values being accepted by the outside world. But we must realize that these two are ways of functioning are complementary, and whenever a neurosis manifests, usually the other way of functioning is involved and must be assimilated by the conscious personality, by the conscious ego. Now, in Jung's model, the ego is also a complex. The ego is the complex in the sense that it is the major complex of consciousness, and it grows out of the matrix of unconsciousness that's associated with mother and child, and is part of the bonding, the initial bonding. Between mother and child. The ego is what develops in terms of a sense of identity. Now, when there is a neurotic breakdown in the personality, that is a difficulty in adaptation, or a difficulty in terms of one-sidedness of the personality. Because remember that whenever a person thinks that this is the only way to function, and devalues the other ways of functioning and meets situations where it doesn't work anymore, he is really obliged to reevaluate his view of human nature. Either that or becomes very bitter and stays neurotic. And right there is the difference between between chronic neurosis and what I call acute. Chronic neurosis, the prognosis for chronic neurosis, I think, is not very good, because it involves an ego that is not strong enough to envision a situation where the way it functions is not best, even though it is suffering. So that kind of situation becomes chronic, and all the person can do is go around and around in its own limited psychology, which is inevitably one-sided, and never break out. And that can go on for many, many years. Acute neurosis, what I'm calling acute neurosis, is something which happens when a person is apparently functioning quite satisfactorily, and suddenly, or more or less suddenly, meets a situation that they can't deal with. Now then it depends very much on the conscious ego assessing the situation and realizing that something is wrong, that the way in which they have viewed the world up until then no longer works and therefore can be improved. Now that depends very much on a strong ego. And that strength, more and more, seems to me, is also very dependent on very early life, and a good connection to a positive mother figure in one's life, whether it's the personal mother or some feminine figure in the background. Now this time, after four, after three, we see the activation of symptoms. Now these symptoms can be not only things like depression and anxiety, nameless fears, often fears of the unconscious, because at this point, one of the dominant fears is of being overwhelmed by the unknown. One experiences often a lot of confusion and chaos, and the typical comment is, I don't know what to believe anymore. That is a very positive sign, because it suggests that there is a breaking up of the conscious attitude which led to the inability to function in the first place. And it seems to me, from my experience, that that has to happen before some new attitude, there's room for a new attitude to take over. Now this, at this point too, when the ego is threatened with being overwhelmed by these unconscious contents, like the inferior function, the other attitude, and these different compounds, at this point, the dangers that Jung points out from time to time in his work of psychosis become more real.
Would you read that out, please?
Pardon?
Would you read that out, what you put in the block for?
Sorry, activation of symptoms. The ego is threatened by unconscious content. And as I was saying, at this point, the danger of psychosis is real when the ego is not strong enough to have a relationship to these contents that are coming up. And these may be images that turn up in dreams, or they may be unconscious contents that are experienced in the outside world. At this stage of the process, of the neurotic process, one very often has accidents. Now, automobile accidents and just physical accidents of one kind and another can actually precipitate a neurosis. They can be the precipitating factor in the ego's realizing that they are in a situation that is inappropriate for the personality.
And we all know of people who are in situations that they continually complain of without doing anything about them. Those situations are ripe for something suddenly to happen, like an accident of one kind or another. Now that often breaks the rigidity of the conscious ego enough to make change possible.
Now the other characteristic at this point is a conflict. Conflict between the ego and, let's say for short, the unconscious, but really I mean the unconscious contents that have been activated. And this involves the other ways of functioning, and I think primarily the shadow. I want to read you a short passage a young man wrote about the shadow in his letters. And from this, I think you'll see that what Jung feels about the shadow and the ego that they are throughout life in opposition. And what is required is a relationship between the two, not the suppression of the other side of the personality, but a relationship between the two that allows some life, however limited, for them both. And this is what Jung writes. This is about the shadow. Now he says it's very difficult and important question. What is called he says to the person who writes to him, what you call the technique of dealing with the shadow. There is, as a matter of fact, no technique at all, inasmuch as technique means that there is a known and perhaps even prescribable way to deal with a certain difficulty or task. It is rather a dealing comparable to diplomacy or statesmanship. It can be a question of goodwill or diplomatic cunning or civil war or anything. If one can speak of a technique at all, it consists solely in an attitude. First of all, one has to accept and to take seriously into account the existence of the shadow. And by that he means that one has to consciously acknowledge that there are aspects of oneself that one doesn't like. And also, on the positive side, there are aspects of oneself that are currently unrealized and part of one's unlived life, and that if they aren't given attention, they'll come in the back door, so to speak, and demand that attention. Okay. Secondly, it is necessary to be informed about its qualities and its intentions. Now the process of being informed about the qualities and intentions of one's shadow really requires becoming conscious of the way one functions and what one's psychology is. Now that means, in a sense, mapping one's psychology, and this is what happens in analysis through working with dreams and other unconscious material. You get a picture of your unconscious. Now Jung's model is only one of many. I happen to like it, but it gives a picture within which one can see different elements of the personality. And getting to know one's shadow means paying particular attention to where one's energy wants to go, and the impulses into the outside world particularly. Thirdly, writes Jung, long and difficult negotiations will be unavoidable. By negotiations,
between the ego and the shadow. Jung means, first of all, an acceptance that the other side of the personality has as much of a right to exist as what one feels conscious of. So that when you feel some impulses towards something that you consciously are not keen about, negotiating with that shadow impulse doesn't necessarily mean letting it have its head, but in actually talking to him or her. And this can often involve a very fruitful dialogue with the other side of oneself. It often helps to personify what Jung called the complexes, whether it's the shadow or the contrasexual side of oneself. And you actually have a dialogue and ask that side of yourself what it wants. You see, overall, what Jung has called the individuation process is not giving overdue weight to the unconscious and what it wants, but a balance between what consciousness wants and what the unconscious seems to want. Now, the only way we know what the unconscious seems to want is by these impulses that come out of nowhere, what we call nowhere, and from what we see in dreams or from other products of the unconscious, like drawings. There we can often, this is always problematical, but we can often get a handle on what the other side of the personality wants. Then it's up to the conscious ego personality to decide to what extent this can be realized in life, because the unconscious doesn't give a hoot about who you're married to or what you do for a living. It's just responding to your attitudes. Now, there are often things that the unconscious wants that are disastrous if they're realized and acted out by the conscious personality. That's what the ego has to tell these different complexes. That's what Jung means by long and difficult negotiations. In fact, he has a story himself. I think that von Franz tells this one, where he was with an Alisande once, and he suddenly had a strong impulse to throw her out the window, and so he looked over his left shoulder and he said, "Oh, all right, but let me do it." Now, by that he meant let his consciousness mediate the impulse. Now, that's the difference between a primitive reaction to what's going on in the unconscious and a civilized reaction. The civilized reaction is mediation. The primitive reaction is strictly acting on an impulse. Transcendent function, Jung is not referring to a transcendent reality like a religious use of the word transcendent. What he means there, and you can read about this in Volume 8 of his collected works in an article called The Transcendent Function and in other places too, is he means something that develops out of the ability of the ego to hold the conflict that involves the tension between itself and what's coming up from the unconscious. Now, what that means is